It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. The boar-tide in Turnagain Arm is an amazing phenomenon that is seen few places in the world. A wall of water that rushes in on a clockwork schedule, vast and intimidating. So why not surf on it? On today's show, we'll meet some of the hardy folks who ride that big wave and talk about surfing the remote shores and big waves found all along Alaska's coast. I have three guests today. Scott Dickerson, who is a Homer surfer and surfs all over Alaska and has really made a career out of it. We're going to hear from Steve Gill of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration to talk about how the boar tide works, what creates this amazing wall of water. And towards the end of the show, we'll hear from Leif Ramos, who's a paddleboarder here in Anchorage and has surfed the boar tide many times. But my first guest is Scott Dickerson, who joined me on his way back from the Shumigan Islands, where he had been out finding new waves. So tell me, where are you just coming back from right now?
I'm just here in Anchorage right now on my way home from a trip on a boat. My friend owns a boat called the Milo that we do surf trips on. It's a 58-foot decommissioned seiner, so it was bought out of a fishery, and so it can no longer commercial fish, and so we've repurposed it for surf trips. And we were just down in the Shumigan Islands and surfed a little bit around Chignik as well, but just exploring some new places, or in our westward expansion, we're calling it.
So tell me how you do that. Do you just like get in the boat and drive down the shore until you see some big waves and hop out and surf?
Yeah, it's not always that easy, but that's kind of the gist of it.
Yeah. I mean, so that sounds, first of all, maybe I'm getting old, but that just sounds really dangerous. Like there could be rocks, there could be all kinds of things that could go wrong. But are you able to just sort of look at it and figure out like this is a good place to surf or not? And tell me how you do that.
Yeah, it's funny actually. We feel like it's pretty safe because one of the main things is surfing around the world. Generally, one of the major risks is getting cuts from the reef. That's like kind of your most common surfing injury is a reef cut. And here we're wearing thick wetsuits that are almost like, they're soft, but they sort of feel like body armor. And the only sharks around here are salmon sharks. And so those are the two biggest, things that would keep someone out of the water, probably keep them away from surfing in most of the world. But here, we don't worry about either of those at all. There's cold and there's the remoteness of what we're doing are the main concerns that people would have. And, as you can probably understand, being in the wilderness is what we love. So we're not worried about the remote aspects. And as far as the physical dangers, it's mostly just being out at sea in a boat. The surfing is quite safe.
I mean, it seems in a way like pretty idyllic because I guess I certainly and probably many, many other people like being out on wilderness beaches and just checking them out and beachcombing. But you actually have a goal, right? And a goal always makes things more fun.
Yeah, that's something that we kind of talk about a lot is why else would we ever be out there? Why would we be exploring the coast of the Shumigan Islands in the middle of September? There's like no other reason. Maybe birding, but that's not really our thing. We like to see the birds, but we wouldn't go that far for birding. And other than that, there's people fishing, and that's it. Those are the only people we see really are fishermen. And the odd, maybe a tanker going by or a cargo ship, but it is really an amazing reason to be out there, and that's what a lot of it is. We love riding waves, and that's why we go, but half the experience at least is just being out there hiking around on these beaches that you would never otherwise go to. Just being in the wilderness is an amazing, amazing thing.
Yeah, that does sound fabulous. When I'm out there, I'm kind of hoping for calm water, right? Like are you looking for storms? Do you really want really bad gnarly waves?
Well, it's kind of what we're looking for is a tricky thing. We want there to be big waves and light winds blowing offshore, which unfortunately doesn't happen all that often, but we're constantly looking for it, and sometimes we find it. But sometimes we also have to settle for big waves and onshore winds, which aren't as good for surfing, but can usually still have some fun. And it's a tricky thing. Finding good surfing conditions is quite difficult, and especially when you're exploring new places where there's no local knowledge to refer to. You just have to go out there and figure it out on your own. And the tides are a major part of everything. The beaches, as the tide comes in and out, that really changes the way the waves break. And as you know, Alaska has big tides. So there's a lot of unknowns and a lot of just trial and error exploring, but that's part of the fun.
So you want the wind to be blowing slightly offshore because that helps the waves break in a certain way? Yeah. And that's pretty unusual in Alaska because usually the water's cooler than the land, so you have an onshore breeze most of the time.
Yeah, a lot of what we end up looking for is when we're out exploring is something like an island where the swell and the wind might be traveling the same direction, but then the swell can wrap around an island. And unfortunately, the wind can wrap around an island too. But sometimes it doesn't. And that's often what we end up looking for, is a place that can get the swell but is sheltered from the wind.
So a couple of practical questions here. One, obviously, that everybody's thinking about is how cold it is. And I know you're wearing a wetsuit, basically. So a really thick wetsuit. So basically, you're not going to get hypothermia. But your head and your hands and stuff are exposed, right? Don't you, like, kind of freeze?
Well, this time of year, we're out there just laughing and marveling how warm it is, honestly, as this water has been warming up all summer. And so the fall time for us is the really warm time of year to be surfing. And it's cold, yes, relative to tropical locations. But honestly, we take people out surfing with us often, and almost everybody is surprised at how warm the water is. And it's not that it feels warm, but with adequate gear, it's really not a problem at all. In fact, a lot of times people will be pulling their hoods off. We wear hoods that are attached to the wetsuits. They'll be pulling their hood off and going, "Wow, I can't believe, you know, I thought it'd be freezing cold, and here I'm sweating." And we wear thick gloves and booties, so the only part of our face that is, our body that is exposed, is our face. And sometimes it's so warm that we'll surf without our hood on. And the wetsuits are really incredible. It's hard to believe how warm they are until you've tried it. You can jump in the water and just be totally comfortable.
And I've actually done quite a bit of swimming in Ketchikan Bay without a wetsuit on. And what I've always noticed is that it's actually the air temperature that affects you a lot. I mean, it's the water temperature is never going to go below a certain level. And granted, you can't stay in it all that long without a wetsuit. But if it's a cold day, then it's really, somehow it's just a much more difficult experience. How does the air temperature affect you when you're surfing?
I'd say that we surf in such an extreme range of conditions. We surf in the middle of winter in Homer, where there's literally ice in the ocean. The ocean is freezing. And then it's very different than now, where our surf trip we just finished, the water was, I think, 55 degrees nearby at a observation site that read water temperatures. And that's warm. I mean, that's warm by California and Oregon standards. I mean, it's not warmer than those locations, but people there surf in water that cold sometimes too. And so we were wearing our thin wetsuits, and some people were surfing without gloves. So under these conditions, the water is quite warm, and the wind is the biggest factor, really, as far as something that changes on a daily basis. The wind will take a lot of heat off of you. But in the middle of the winter, the water is very cold, the air is very cold, and I'd say that the water and the wind are both major components to deal with, but definitely the wind is more significant than you might think at first.
You can't say which is worse than the other, yeah.
Yeah.
So the other thing that strikes me is that taking a big boat like that on a long trip is really expensive. How does that work out? Is it like, are you guiding people, or how do you pay for all this, if you don't mind me asking?
Yeah, no, it's we have a really great situation where my friend Mike McCune, who owns the boat, he owns a fish processing plant in Homer, and he's been really putting a lot of his own money into this boat and making these trips possible. On this particular trip, it was a trip with customers. We had some friends help cover the costs with us to get down to the Shumagin Islands. They just came for about a 5-day trip. And then once we were there, we met our customers that were basically hired us as guides, as well as we, you know, of course, give them a place to sleep. We transport them around. We feed them and take care of stuff for them. And so they're paying what we think is a pretty reasonable rate. And it covers our costs. Nobody's making any money off it, but we are able to keep going and have a lot of fun ourselves. And it's definitely, it's not It's not something that we're counting on to make our living at this point, but we also don't want to be spending very much money to go do these things either. So it's a tricky balance, but it's working out. And as long as Mike is so dedicated and he can find crew members like myself to help him out, it's working good.
Yeah, and you're, I mean, in terms of a sort of a product, it's a one of a kind. Like, it's sort of like your mountain that nobody's climbed, beach that nobody's ever surfed, right? I mean, that's a pretty special thing.
Yeah, it's not uncommon for our guests to say this is a trip of a lifetime. And we get a lot of professional surfers and people that are really experienced, have surfed all around the world. They see an opportunity to come and surf in Alaska, and that catches their interest because it's such a unique opportunity. And they're not disappointed. They always leave really amazed. And often what they'll say is something like, you know, it was such an incredible experience, and we got to surf, because the rest of the experience is so amazing to them. Just the wilderness is so overwhelming, and the beauty, and just being in such a remote place where there's no other people around, and we're surfing waves that may have never been surfed before. And
yeah, it really is special. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth. I'm talking with Scott Dickerson, a famous Alaska surfer. That's a set of words that probably wouldn't have been put together in the past, but now are. And Scott has surfed all over Alaska in really remote places. And now I want to get into talking about the Boretide and Turnagain Arm, because that's a pretty unique wave. I mean, that's not the sort of thing that many people have surfed on. What's that like, and how does that compare to surfing on a breaking wave on a beach?
It's very odd. It's a phenomenal thing, and it's not really like anything else. A friend in Girdwood, Jeff Hoke, first told myself and Mike about it. He said, you guys got to come out and check this thing out. He said he'd been surfing on a stand-up paddleboard, whereas it's kind of a new sport, stand-up paddling, and it really has made the Boretide a lot of fun because of the specific attributes of stand-up paddling make being out there on the Boretide a lot more enjoyable and easier, and you can ride the wave for longer. And so we went out there, and he showed us the ropes, and Mike and I both spent a lot of time chasing the bore wave and surfing it for a couple of years, and lately we haven't been doing it so much because it's a 7-hour round-trip drive for us to catch one wave, which is worth it sometimes, and sometimes it's not, but the 7-hour drive does get old.
Well, and it's a very different kind of wave, because it's sort of like just a pile of water that comes in, right? I mean, as opposed to a wave that's breaking and maybe lifting you up. How do you surf on it? Do you just try to stay on that frothy part on the front?
It's actually, if you watch it, it's constantly changing. And when it's best for surfing, it's not just a pile of frothing water. It actually looks just like a breaking ocean wave. And there's times on it where you'd have a hard time distinguishing it from a normal ocean wave, other than the fact that clearly it's not breaking onto a beach. It's going up essentially a river current. So when it's at its best, or when it's the best for surfing, it's basically just like surfing an ocean wave, but it's constantly fluctuating based on the depth of the channel and the amount of wave energy. And sometimes it is just a frothing foam pile, and you just got to hang on and hope that it cleans back up and turns into a nice, clean, breaking wave again.
So you mentioned using a paddleboard as opposed to a traditional surfboard. Have you done it both ways, or mostly with a paddleboard?
I've never surfed a Boretide with a normal, traditional surfboard, mostly just because you have to be out there in the arm waiting for the wave for a while, usually. And it depends. I mean, there's all sorts of ways of surfing it and accessing it, but the ideal way is you park your car, you go out into Turnagain Arm, and you ride the current, because it's essentially a river at low tide. You ride the current down, and then you catch the wave, and you surf it back up to your car. And you could do that on a normal surfboard, but you'd be laying out there in the arm for, you know, half an hour maybe. And it's really nice just to be standing up on a board, enjoying the view and out of the water. The Turnagain Arm is not... It's muddy, it's super silty. It's not really water that I like to be in. I like to stand on it. As well, the paddleboard also is much better for surfing when the wave becomes very small, which it often does during a good ride. There'll be small sections, and it'll build back up and get big again. And with a normal surfboard, you have a hard time keeping up with it. And sometimes you have to paddle to keep with the wave because it becomes so small. And with a paddleboard, that's no problem. and then the wave might grow back and you'll be surfing again, and then it'll shrink again. And sometimes you can even fall off of it, and with a paddleboard you can catch back up to it usually, whereas you can't do that with a normal surfboard.
So how long could you actually ride the wave?
Our longest ride was about 5 miles in about 50 minutes.
Well, it's kind of amazing. I mean, that's a very unique thing. It must have felt really special.
Yeah, we couldn't believe it. It's like that, you know, looking at the map, like, that really was, I mean, it felt like a long time, but you think after a ride like that, you think that must have been at least 20 minutes. And then you look at your watch and realize that you were riding it for 50 minutes.
Amazing. And so where would you park? I mean, and how would you time it to actually catch the wave? I mean, because you're driving all the way from home, it would be a real bummer if you missed it, right?
Yeah. Yeah, you spend the three and a half hours driving up from Homer hoping that you got your math right and that you read the tide chart correctly, because you really don't want to pull up and see that you're 5 minutes late. It doesn't wait. It's a one-wave deal. It's a one-shot. But it depends on where you're at in the arm and what the tide's doing, what the winds are doing. It's never exactly on time. It seems like it's always a little bit different, but it's usually within half an hour of when it's predicted. And there's prediction points. I think that the DNR actually publishes. There's publicly available information. It's really easy to find online for specific spots. Those spots are not necessarily good spots to surf the wave, but from there you can sort of estimate, okay, if it's here, you know, at 3 p.m., I want to catch it a half mile further up the arm, and it should be there in about 20 minutes or whatever.
Yeah, and we've got that information on our website alaskapublic.org. Just scroll down to today's show on board tide surfing, and you can find the information on when the board tide could be expected in Turnagain Arm. Where do you normally park, and where do you find is the best place to catch a wave and get started?
It's just different all the time. I haven't been surfing it this year, but it's become very popular in the last few years. And if someone is interested in learning about it, I would say just drive down to, I think it's Bird Point, and look at the chart and figure out when to be there. And you'll see a bunch of people probably down there surfing it, and talk to the people doing it. And I couldn't tell you where to go when. It's different all the time. The channels are constantly changing. There's so much silt moving in the arm that a good place to surf today might not be very good tomorrow. The tide it's different every day. But generally what happens is in the spring, the channels get sort of set up, and then they stay relatively similar throughout the summer, but the tide is always different, so that changes it. But the channels often will stay kind of similar throughout the summer, but then the next year, it'll likely be totally different.
So I want to let you go here in a minute, but I want to kind of focus a little bit on how people can get into surfing in Alaska. You kind of started out here as a kid, and you had this dream of surfing. Most people learn probably to start surfing in Hawaii and then try it here. What do you think? Is Alaska a good place to learn how to surf?
It's a difficult place because, for one thing, finding waves is really challenging here. And I'd say that's the biggest challenge. The cold you can deal with proper equipment, but you can't find waves easily. There's a few places in Alaska where waves are more accessible. Kodiak Island and Yakutat really are the two easiest places, but getting to Kodiak or Yakutat is not necessarily easily, unless you live there, I suppose, but very few do. So access is the biggest challenge, and that's actually why I usually recommend people start with stand-up paddleboarding, because it's something that you can do on any body of water. Just even here in Anchorage, you can go out on the lagoons or the lakes, and you learn the skills of balancing on a board. It's really enjoyable. You get to experience a lot of the wonders of being in and around the water. And you can ride waves, too, if you have the opportunity to be around breaking waves. Paddleboards are great for riding waves. And you can learn to read the surf. You can learn to ride it. And then if you want to start doing more traditional surfing, you've already got a lot of the skills.
And I guess there's probably guides like you who are ready to take, once you know what you're doing, to take people out to more exotic locales, and you know where to find those spots and stuff like that. It's not something I can imagine just sort of doing on my own.
Yeah, some people do, but it's difficult. And like I said, it's mostly the access logistic is the most challenging, because figuring out when there's going to be waves and where is a major challenge. And then you have to have all the proper equipment. And these questions are actually the reason why I started a website called surfalaska.net. And it's a website that's devoted strictly to surfing in Alaska. And it's a lot of photos and stories and information. And I've also been selling paddleboards and wetsuits and all the equipment that people need to get started as well. Because when I started, it was really hard to figure all this out. It took me years before I had adequate equipment and knew how to predict a wave and where to go, literally years. And so once I became somewhat proficient, I really wanted to share the stories as well as help people figure out what they need and where to go to learn what they need. And I have paddleboard dealers in Anchorage. I sell them in Homer. The boards are available for rent in Homer and Wasilla and Anchorage. And there's a lot of people. Over the last few years, I've sold hundreds of boards.
Excellent. And that site also will be at alaskapublic.org if people want to find it and look at for today's show on board tide surfing. And thanks so much for being with me, Scott.
My pleasure.
We'll all be planning out a route we're gonna take real soon. We're waxing down our surfboard. We can't wait for June. We'll all be gone for the summer. We're on safari to stay.
So thanks to Scott Dickerson, an amazing surfer who has done so much stuff around Alaska. We're going to have a break, and when we come back, we'll be hearing from a scientist who will hopefully explain how the bore tide works. It is a very unusual phenomenon worldwide. But first, it's time for a break. Last summer, Robert Stormo got a hankering to try something new. He set his sights on surfing the Cook Inlet bore tide, and he invited KSKA reporter Dave Waldron along to witness his first crack at it. Stormo's first time surfing the bore tide was also his last. Here's Dave Waldron's report.
Surfing is one of the few sports that most Alaskans haven't tried. Our water is freezing, our beaches are rocky, and there aren't many places to catch good waves. But none of that kept Robert Stormo from doing it. He recently tried surfing in Alaska for the first time after being stranded on St. George Island for 7 days because of poor flying conditions. On the sixth day, Stormo and his co-worker thought they were finally going to get to leave, but their flight was full.
So that Sunday at the airport, after we see everybody leave and like they're happy to be going home and stuff, we decide to go surfing.
And it turned out that surfing was exactly what the pair needed.
Being out there kind of made me forget about all the disappointment that I had just experienced. And it was so much fun.
That's not to say it was easy. Stormo says his hands and ears were freezing and that the waves were intense. Also, he got pretty nervous after he spotted a couple of seals.
Just 2 days prior, there were like killer whales swimming out there, and whales eat seals.
Stormo is going to try surfing again, only this time he'll be riding the Turnagain Arm bore tide, a tide that's famous for its waves that can reach up to 10 feet. The bore tide is one of the biggest in the world, but it still doesn't draw many surfers, mainly because it's just a single wave. Also, the water is really cold, which is why we're going to rent a dry suit for this adventure. For that, meet Bobby, short for
Borislav Paunovsky. It means a peacock, my last name, on my language.
Bobby works for Alaska Raft and Kayak, one of the few places in Anchorage you can rent a dry suit and board combo. The board Stormo will be renting is typically used for paddleboarding, but it's more appropriate for his purposes. It's large and sturdy, two traits Stormo wants if he's going to ride a bore tide. Unlike a standard board, this one is filled with an air pump.
Screw it in. Pump. I've heard that if you pump them, you can pump them up to 15 PSI. Mm. So they come really hard, and I've heard guys tell that they're better than regular surfboards.
When Bobby finds out Stormo will be trying to ride the bore tide, he looks slightly concerned.
You're gonna ride the tide?
Yeah, we'll try to.
It's rocky, yeah. If okay. You flip, there's like...
I could die.
Yeah, yeah. Not you can die, you can get stuck.
Getting stuck in Turnagain Arm also seems like it could equate to dying. At this point, we're both questioning if all of this was a terrible idea. But later that evening, Stormo is ready to go. The drive out to the arm is windy, and it's pouring rain. Still, his spirits are high.
Yeah, I'm really excited to try this out. Something completely different.
One thing we have to do is race the bore tide. We leave Anchorage about an hour after the tide begins to form. But we're confident we can drive fast enough to get in front of it.
None of the gear is ready, so... we just have to be NASCAR team efficient. Also, I guess just keep an eye on the bore tides. We've got to be quick.
Once we pass Girdwood, we're able to overtake the tide and find a place to park. Time for our best NASCAR impression.
While you put the wetsuit on, I'll try and pump your board up.
All right. Okay, let's do this.
And just in the nick of time, we're able to walk on the beach to witness the incoming bore tide. Stormo wastes no time getting in the water.
All right, you got it, man.
I don't know if it's because we're closer to it now, but that tide looks pretty huge all of a sudden. And I'm glad I'm the one standing safely on the beach. When Stormo gets hit by the bore tide, he is swept up and has to cling to his board to stay on. He's able to get up on one knee for a few seconds, but when the tide passes him, the water pulls him side to side and he's forced back on his belly. With the tide gone, it's now a matter of paddling across the inlet against what is now very choppy water. For a minute, it looks like he's going to get dragged out further to sea, but he's able to use his legs to get back to the beach.
If I were to kick that last, like, 30 yards, I still would have been out there probably trying to paddle. My arms would have fallen off.
Stormo looks a little seasick. He says the tide surprised him.
It came so fast, faster than I expected. I knew it wouldn't be easy, but I'm gassed right now. I'm glad I tried it, though.
Glad he tried it now. But after the adrenaline wears off and we make it back to Anchorage, he's thinking his next surfing adventure will be someplace warm, somewhere far away from Turnigan Arm.
It was beautiful, but I'm done with the bore tide. I've got it out of my system and won't be doing it ever again.
I'm Dave Waldron.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on KSKA Anchorage. The program repeats tonight at 9 o'clock on FM 91.1. Connect with Outdoor Explorer anytime. Download podcasts and see what's coming up on future programs by going to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth, and today we're talking about the bore tide, surfing the bore tide in Turnigan Arm, and Alaska surfing in general, and also want to learn more about the bore tide, what creates it, and what creates our huge tidal differences here in Anchorage. And for that, we're lucky to have Steve Gill on the line with us from Washington. He's a senior scientist with the Tides and Currents Program at NOAA, the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration. Thanks for being with us, Steve.
Sure, I'm happy that I could make it.
So the bore tide is this wall of water that comes rushing up Turnigan Arm, and I guess it's a pretty unusual phenomenon. It's not found in all that many places around the world. Is that true?
Yeah, there's only a couple handfuls of places around the world, typically in similar, you know, geographic and geological settings that Turnigan Arm is in. At the upper ends of estuaries that have large ranges of tide, and these arms and rivers that come off and finger off the estuaries are very shallow, usually typically mud flats at low tide.
So the bore tide is essentially the leading edge of the incoming tide. Is that true?
That's right. It's the incoming high tide, which is, you know, typically a tide that comes in from the ocean as a nice, fairly smooth sine wave, if you think of it mathematically, a sinusoid.
Mm-hmm.
High is the high tide, and the trough is the low tide that comes into the estuaries. But that wave gets severely distorted with shallow water, and that's what happens in the extreme at these bore tides. It's a very extremely distorted high tide coming in, such that the high water is abrupt. It's a wall of white water.
So as we've talked to surfers, I guess when they're in the water, the water is running out, and then the bore tide comes in, and so essentially there's for a brief period at least, there's a current that's coming in the arm on top while the water underneath is going out, because this bore tide is actually a big slug of water that's just pouring into Turnigan Arm.
Right. So in these low-lying mud flats, they're, you know, have fingering, you know, rivulets or tidal sloughs or rivers that are the expression of the low tide that is going out from the previous high tide. And so it isn't like just a flat, you know, plane of water. It's these rivers of water that are going out, that are rushing out, and they meet the incoming high tide, usually near the entrance of these major estuaries where the water gets really shallow really quick. And so the incoming tide meets that shallow water abruptly, raises up, and overtops the outgoing low tide that's in these sloughs. So that the energy from the incoming tide is concentrated. It isn't able to go across all the mud flats all at once, so it concentrates itself on these little riverines or little rivers that are the expression of the low tide, and that rushes up these rivers as a wall of white water.
So, right. So there's all this water's coming in, and it's being narrowed down to a very shallow and narrow little channel, and that helps create the wave, if I understand what you're
saying. That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. So the high tide meets it. It's a shallow, what we, in tides, we call it a shallow water frictional effect, a very abrupt one in technical terms. But essentially, it gets slowed down abruptly by the shallow water and the outgoing tide.
Now, the Bohr tide in Turnagain Arm is quite predictable, and charts are published as to when you can find it going by at a certain time. And that's because the tides in general are highly mathematically predictable. Although I've read, and it's a fascinating subject, the centuries of intense effort that it took for the scientific community to develop the mathematics to understand them, and the mathematics are far from simple, but essentially it's one of these natural phenomena like the rising of the sun and setting of the sun that you can predict years in advance. Is that true?
Well, that's true, yeah. It's the Earth-Moon-Sun system, so both the moon and the sun have tide-producing forces that impinge upon the world's oceans. And so we know in advance whether in some positions are going to be, based upon where they have been, we can mathematically predict that. And so based upon their positions in the future, we can set into place equations that we can analyze the tide signal and predict the tide. So to predict the tide, we have to have observations at a location for a period of time. Then we do a mathematical analysis of the observations and put those results into a prediction equation. So as long as you have a strong tidal signal, such as, you know, Cook Inlet, we can predict times and heights of the high and low waters fairly accurately. Where we don't do a good job is in areas of weak tidal signals and strong, significant input from meteorological signals, weather effects, such as the Chesapeake Bay is a shallow bay, low range of tide. So half the variability of the tide in the Chesapeake Bay is due to the weather, which is not predictable. The other half is due to the tide. So we don't do a very good job of predicting tides and heights in the Chesapeake Bay like we do in the areas of stronger tides.
So why is the tide so much stronger in Cook Inlet? What makes it stronger?
Well, a couple of reasons. In the Gulf of Alaska, it's such that the tides are strong in the Gulf of Alaska to begin with, so in that part of the Pacific Ocean. So when the tides enter the entrance of Cook Inlet, they already have around a 9 or 10, 11-foot tide range already, and then they increase up to, what, over 30, or, you know, 29, 30 feet up at Anchorage.
Even almost up to 40, yeah.
So the reason for that is the unique shape and the symmetry of these estuaries, like Cook Inlet or the Bay of Fundy, many other estuaries. They're narrow estuaries. They have a depth and length that are unique to the tidal energy coming in, such that they resonate with the input forcing. So resonance phenomenon. So they sense the energy coming in and enhance it. So it's a mathematical function called resonance. They actually enhance the tidal energy due to the configuration of the bay itself, such that the tide range at the head of the bay is much larger than the entrance of the bay.
So when you say resonance, I think of a bell, that you might strike a bell with a relatively gentle hit, but that because of the shape of the bell, the frequencies run around the bell and make it louder.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly the same phenomenon.
So our Cookinlet is a well-shaped natural bell for tides, and that's why we get to surf on it.
That's right. So the Bay of Fundy is the same way. The Gulf of Maine has a high range, and if they head of the Bay of Fundy, you have tides, you know, 35 or more feet.
Right, and we're familiar also with the fact that sometimes the tides are bigger and the bore tide is bigger than other times, and that kind of can be predicted a little bit by the phase of the moon, right?
Right, so it's usually the maximum bore tides occur in most places when you have what's called a negative tide, which is a low water that's lower than the regular chart datum. It's below the regular chart datum. So there are
right, so just to explain that, I mean,
when
we say a zero tide, that means sort of the mean low water. So that's the average low tide, and a lower one would be a minus number.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the tide prediction tables are relative to mean low water. So they're usually in the tide tables either above or below that mean low water. And that's the datum that's on our documentary NOAA nautical charts.
I see.
So generally, the stronger tides occur during times of perigee or spring tides. It's called syzygy, but the syzygy or spring tides are the same as the time of a full or new moon, and that's when the Earth and Sun are in alignment, and so the Sun and the Moon are acting together. And then you have times of perigee during each month where the Moon is closest to the Earth in its monthly orbit. And they're not in sync all the time, but 4 to 6 times a year, the times of perigee align themselves with the times of a spring tide, either a full moon or a new moon. And so at those times, you get even higher tides than even a regular spring tide. You have two things adding together to cause extreme highs and extreme lows. And so when you get the extreme lows, you have, in Turnagain Arm, you have even more shallow water mudflat exposure coming down to meet the high tide. So it's unique, you know, the elevation of these mud flats versus the elevation of a high tide at the lowest waters makes for a more, you know, higher phenomenon of the tidal bore.
I see. And so it's a combination both of the alignment of the sun and moon. So if the moon is aligned with the sun, the moon will either be full or it'll be a new moon, in combination with the moon being unusually close to the Earth, so more gravitational pull. And I guess that cycle will move around on something like a 16-year repetition, right, before it repeats.
Well, that's for, there's a, we have an 18.6-year cycle, but that's more to do with the declination of the moon.
I see. So then we get it very complicated.
The perigee cycle and the full and new moons, they'll get in sync 4 to 6 times a year, depending on where you are.
I see.
So you'll have the strongest events are when perigee and full moon occur on the same day. And then usually the highest tides and lowest tides have about a day or so lag. It isn't right at the event. It takes about a day to get the highest and lowest.
Huh.
But the tides are generally high or low leading up to the maximum event and then for a couple of days afterwards.
And those are the days when you want to be out there on Turnagain Arm getting a good look at it. Well, this has
really
been an interesting education. I really appreciate your taking the time. I know you're traveling. Steve Gill, he's the senior scientist with the Tides and Currents Program at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Thanks so much for being with us, Mr. Gill.
Sure thing. It's been my pleasure.
Right now it's time for another quick break. The Turnagain Arm bore tide may seem huge to us, but over in China, there's another bore tide that lures wave runners from across the world. It's called the Silver Dragon. Our producer, Monica Goki, has more.
What if I told you there's a wave that you can ride for over 10 miles? A wave so powerful, it has killed hundreds of people and been called one of the 7 wonders of the world. A wave so feared that the locals named it the Silver Dragon. What if I told you this wave is in a river? Would you believe me?
That dutiful clip was from a YouTube video introducing surfers to the Qiangtang tidal bore wave. Surfing tidal bores is somewhat of a new thing, and the professional surfing industry is getting in on the action.
Once again, Red Bull and Wapsano have teamed up to put on the only surf contest of its kind on the Qiantong River in Hangzhou, China.
Even the world's best surfers are kind of blown away by the Silver Dragon.
It's this crazy river wave that runs for miles that you can surf.
It's straight up a tsunami through a river.
Words are hard to describe exactly how you feel when it arrives.
Just seeing it isn't enough. Actually riding the wave is just surreal.
Man, when it turns up, it's something special, something that I've never seen before.
Like probably one of the most unique waves in the world.
Yeah, I mean, it's just it's cool.
Here's the deal. Unlike an ocean wave, which rolls in for a bit and breaks near shore, a bore tide keeps its shape for a very long time. Tidal bores happen when the leading edge of the incoming tide forms a wave of water that travels up either a river or a narrow bay. And the surfability of bore tides is catching on. 2 weeks ago, the second Red Bull event was held on the Silver Dragon bore tide in China. And over the weekend in New Brunswick, Canada, two surfers logged a record-setting 18-mile, two-and-a-half-hour ride on the tidal bore on the Petit Kodiak River. A wave you can ride for hours? Surfers are saying, yes, please. Tidal bores are in right now, no pun intended. For Outdoor Explorer, I'm Monica Goki.
It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth, and we're back with more of our show about surfing, and especially surfing the bore tide in Turnagain Arm. And my next guest has quite a bit of experience doing this on a paddleboard. Life Ramos has been basically thinking about surfing. It sounds like just about when he came out of the womb. You're telling me that you got to tell this story that you were telling me during the break about how you went surfing for the first time, like when you were just a baby in arms.
Yeah, it's a story my mom told me when I was 12 about my uncle coming and picking me up out of the hospital while she had to stay for minor complications, and he brought me down to Waikiki Beach and took me out and surfed with me in his arms, and she showed up at the beach very unhappy.
Is that highly recommended for newborn babies, right? Yeah, maybe in Hawaii it is.
Shouldn't be a problem. I'm still here.
Yeah, that's right. So surfing got like deeply into your blood, and how did you get into it? So you pretty much have lived in Alaska, but you're from Hawaii originally, but you grew up in Alaska mostly. Yeah.
Hawaiian-born, Alaskan bred.
Mm-hmm. So how did you get into surfing here in Alaska?
It's just always been on my mind, and, you know, I've been interested in the bore tide since I heard about it in science class and junior high, and, you know, everybody tells you, don't go out there, you're going to die, you're going to get sucked into the mud. And
that's what I remember, it's like, don't go in the water, it's deadly, right?
Yeah, and, you know, I had a little bit of that voice stayed in the back of my head when I was younger, and I would watch the surfers and kayakers out there whenever we were in passing and driving when I was younger. Parents are like, don't even think about it. And I was always thinking about it.
That's what makes you want to do it. Yeah.
Yeah. And I used to watch a guy, I don't know if I get his name right. I never met him, but I watched him surf a lot on a longboard out there. Girdwoodian, his name's Wooly. Mm-hmm. Like I said, I never met him, but I watched him surf a lot and, you know, had a lot of admiration, you know, sitting on shore watching, you know, taking photos, shooting video, studying what it did.
Mm-hmm. So, when did you give it your first try?
I mean, first time I went actually went out in the water, 07. And I took a boogie board out there, and you know, my first time I went in, I went in the wrong spot, and I was floating backwards, watching the guardrail, going, okay, the wave should be here any second. And next thing you know, I was floating forwards, watching the guardrail and going the opposite way, going, hey, wait a minute. And I look up and all the surfers are standing up on the wave, so I was in the wrong spot. So the next day I got in on the right spot, but unfortunately, since I was very inexperienced at what the wave did past the viewing point there on the road, I ended up staying in the water for like 4 hours and had to hike out across the arm through Ingram Creek.
Because you just ended up in the wrong spot at the end of the ride?
Well, you know, I'd never been in the water at that point, so it was my first try, and the wave had its way with me, pushed me out onto the mud flats. I ended up skimboarding on the mud flats for a little while on my boogie board, and then I ended up riding the current, and then I passed Girdwood, and I was like, hey, I've never seen anybody do this before. I think I'm in the wrong place. This, this has gotten real. And so eventually, since I couldn't kick out towards the Girdwood side of the highway, I swam to the middle because that's where the current brought me. Then I hiked out across the mudflats to the other side of the arm. And then I had a decision to make, you know, walk to Hope or go to Ingram Creek. I'm like, you know, I have no idea where I'm at. So I went towards Ingram Creek, and, you know, a few hours later, I ended up there and had to get back in the water and kick against the current to get back to the bridge there, right there when you go to Turnigan Pass. And it took longer for me to hitchhike back than it did to hike out.
Really. Like soaking wet guy with a boogie board.
In the middle of a rainstorm.
Yeah.
It was a lot of fun.
So this is how not to do it.
That is exactly how not
All right,
to do
so
it.
Let's talk about how to do it. You do it primarily on a paddle board, I've been told. Which, so you're upright, you're out of the water, you have some control and some speed.
Well, when you paddle into it, I've never successfully stood up and paddled into one of the waves. The wave always has its way with me when I try that. It's still a goal of mine to be able to do it. I can do it on the, like, the smaller waves. You know, there's not that much power to them. But when it's a real, when it's a sizable, significant wave, you got to lay down and just let it take you, you know. Sometimes it takes me, sometimes it doesn't.
So you're sort of getting to that right spot when you know that the wave is going to be sort of doing the right thing so that it's going to pick you up, essentially?
Yeah, it's basically a big wall of white water. And then once you get up, you know, you try and make your way to the face if there's one. There's a lot of really great surfers and stand-up paddleboarders out there that I learned from by watching. And I still have a ways to go with my progression, but... with the stand-up paddle boards, you get a longer ride out of it than the actual surfers do, just because you have a wider board, a longer board. It's more stable in the turbulent water. Your paddle is kind of like your engine.
Right.
You know, it'll keep you upright if you use it correctly.
And if you fall behind the wave, you can catch up? Or
yeah, well, there's a strategy to that, too. You know, you can catch up to the wave when you fall off if you know how to read the water and work the water to get back in front of it.
Which is all about practice and experience, I would think.
Yeah, but mostly observing, you know, seeing what the water does, paying attention to what the water does, and then just working with it instead of against it.
So, I mean, that sounds almost spiritual. I mean, is it sounds like it's something that you really gets under your skin.
It's my life.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very spiritual to me. I've been using it a lot to deal with, you know, life can get hard sometimes, and there's a lot of healing for me that goes on when I'm in the ocean.
Particularly with the Bortide, or do you do other surfing as well?
Yeah, I've done a lot of surfing out in Kodiak, and there's a lot of talented surfers out there too, and just world-class surf breaks out there that nobody is on, you know, except for some of the Kodiak locals. I've been trying to surf Homer for a long time, but I never get those swells right. It's always, you should have been here yesterday. I'm like,
you got to be there at the right moment. Some storm has just come through or something. So how's the Bortide compare to those other surfing experiences?
It's a completely different entity. You know, like I said, you know, it's a big wall of white water coming at you, and then in certain places it breaks like a real wave, and that's where I'm like, you know, my progression still has to progress, because you know, I'm not in the sweet spot to ride the face of the wave yet. I try, but I'm still learning. I'm still getting things right.
Do some of these professional surfers or top surfers, are they, I mean, they're able to do that, or is that something that the Bortide is so unique that it's its own set of skills?
The only professional I've ever heard about being out there was Laird Hamilton years ago. You know, there's four individuals I know of personally who make that wave look easy. And, you know, I'm constantly watching them and learning. And, you know, they're always in the sweet spot, and they make it look so wonderful, you know. For me, I'm just stoked to be on it and riding it. And, you know, I've had five-second rides. And this year I actually got an hour-and-a-half ride of actual stand-up time, and then get pounded, then paddle back into it and stand up, then get pounded, and then paddle back into it, and then get pounded.
An hour and a half is incredible.
It blew my mind. Like, myself and one other rider, Scott Montablo, we couldn't believe it. We're like, we just got to keep going. We're like, yeah, let's keep going. And uh-huh. Scott was in the sweet spot. I remember at one point in time, I just caught up to the wave, but I was on the way outside, and he was inside. And Scott's like a little over 6 feet tall. And I remember watching him going, you know, that's where I want to be. And the waters were extremely violent. And then the wave kicked up and actually formed a face. And it jacked up over his head. And then all of a sudden, he just took a beating.
Oh,
I was like, oh, I'm going to be right there tomorrow. You know, that's the spot.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, Scott, he always makes that wave look so enjoyable and mm-hmm. easy, you know.
So if you ride it for that long, you must be riding, like, the whole length of Turnagain Arm.
Well, you know, from Bird Point well past the Chugach National Forest sign. But it's not a normal thing. It doesn't mm-hmm. happen like that all the time, you know, because the mud flats are always changing every day.
Right.
there's a few spots where you know it's going to curl on you and form the correct wave to ride.
Uh-huh.
With the water changes and the mud changing and the winds, you know, it's always a crapshoot when you go out there.
Right.
You're kind of like, okay, I got a general idea of where I need to be, so I'm going to be here and see what happens. And then you say, okay, tomorrow I'm going to be here and see what happens, you know. And the tides build up from like a 25-foot water change all the way up to a 40-foot water change when mm-hmm. the full moon cycle comes, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, you just have to pay attention to everything that's going on around you and read the water.
How does the wind and sea state affect you? Because it can be incredibly windy in there.
Yeah. This last week, we had a storm blow through, and I go out no matter what, you know. And the wind can get very challenging. And it's mostly when you want to try and catch the wave if you got a headwind coming at you. You get on the wave. I've had the wind pick my board up and throw me off the wave before.
Yeah.
And then there's no catching it when you try to paddle back up because the wind's working against you.
Right.
Even though the current's working with you.
Mm-hmm.
So you just kind of, you know.
You're done.
You're done. You float around. You kind of enjoy the turbulent water and, you know, just enjoy being out there. And then eventually try and make your way back to your vehicle, whether it's paddling back, which I like to do against the current mostly, you know. It's just a nice little workout afterwards. Or I've hitchhiked back, or other surfers, if they're around, they're always more than willing to give you a ride back.
Mm-hmm. So what are the big, like, danger things or the things that you're particularly careful about where you figure you don't want to lose your life for surfing?
Funny you should ask me that. yeah, I've had a few incidents out there where, you know, you had to fight for your life. Of course, that first experience was definitely
mm-hmm. where you end up where, like, totally out there and you've got to find your way to shore, essentially.
I was inexperienced and lost and
uh-huh.
thought I had a grip on it. And, you know, the one thing about the Boar Tide when you're surfing it is, for me, I learn something every single day that I go out there. And it could be a life lesson. It could be, you know, a lesson in how the water works. It could be a lesson in what the wind does, you know. It could mm-hmm. be a lesson in how people treat you. Mm-hmm. You know, there's some issues out there between surfers, and it usually gets resolved because everybody's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
But some of the dangers, you know, we'll start off with debris in the water.
You
got to pay attention to that. You know, there's been logs that have floated right on by me, and I've been like, oh, that would have
hurt. Huh?
That would have left the mark. You got to pay attention to the water, man, because just when I thought I'm like, I got a grip on all this, you know, I know what to look for, I know what I'm doing. I got pinned down one day. there was a ripple in the water, and I had fallen off the wave, and I was just kind of going with the current. And the water went from a ripple to kind of like a rapid, and then my skegs got stuck in the mud, and then the water was flowing over me and then pinned me to my board.
Which, so the skegs are like the little keel on the bottom of the board.
Fins. Yeah. Yes. And those got stuck into the mud.
Oh my gosh.
And the current pushed both my board and myself down and held me under for a little bit. And I was like, wow, I did not see that coming. And so I kind of was trying to figure out how to get off my board, and I couldn't because I couldn't move. I was literally pinned down.
By the force of the water?
Correct.
Oh, my gosh.
And I managed to get off the board, but the board was still pinned down, and I was getting pushed away, and I grabbed my leash and just kept yanking on it until my board actually got lodged free. And then I said, okay, the next time I see that pattern in the water, I have to avoid that because of...
So you just popped up to the surface after you got loose.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was, wasn't deep water, mm-hmm. you know, at this point. You know, it was only a couple inches at that point when I first got the fins
stuck,
stuck in there. And so at that point, I was like, oh, my board's stuck. I hope I don't break it. But when the rest of the water surge came up on me and it got deeper and deeper, that's when things got really serious.
Almost instantaneous, yeah.
Yeah, just in a matter of a couple minutes, you know.
Uh-huh.
At first, you're not taking it too seriously because you're just kind of like going with it.
It's such a crazy, hostile environment in some ways.
Yeah, in some ways, yes. In other ways, it's just serene and beautiful.
Uh-huh, yeah. So you mentioned like the community of people who's out there, and I guess like every community, it probably has pluses and minuses. Do people help each other? I mean, if there's a newbie, do people generally help somebody out?
Some folks are very open to having you come out there, and others are very much protective of the break.
Mm-hmm.
I see both sides to it. I'm the one that says, hey, if you want to learn, come with me, and I'll teach you what I know.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to have the right mindset to be out there. You know, if you don't, I don't want to play lifeguard.
Right.
I will save you if I can, but it's really, you know, you have to be able to save your own skin.
So you should know how to surf and be pretty confident in your skills to some extent before you take this on.
You should have some kind of understanding of what's going on out there, yes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, don't just grab a pair of shorts and borrow a board and say, hey, I'm going out there. I mean,
you need a wetsuit, first of all.
I studied the wave since junior high,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't do it until 07. And so I had a vague understanding of it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then I had a little surfing experience, very little surfing experience.
Uh-huh.
You know, there has been people out there that I've seen that I see them making a lot of wrong decisions.
Yeah.
But they always seem to come out, you know? There's never been any type of injury or death that I've heard of since I've been out there.
Mm-hmm. So it seems like there'd be plenty of room for everyone.
Yeah, there is. There's enough wave for everyone to be out there as long as whoever goes out there knows that, you know, they have to respect what's going on out there, not just the water and not just, you know, the environment itself, but the people, you know.
Yeah.
If you've got somebody coming up that's been on the wave, you know, you don't just get on the wave right in front of them. You need to give them their room, you know.
Yeah. Well, it's an amazing sport, and you made it sound like amazingly spiritual and deep, and I've got a whole new dimension on it. I really thank you for coming in today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
We were just hearing from Life Ramos, who's a paddleboarder here in Anchorage and has surfed the Boartide many times, as you heard. Before that, we heard from Steve Gill speaking to us from Washington, D.C. He's with the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration. And we started out the show with Scott Dickerson, an Alaska surfer extraordinaire. Next week's show is called Backcountry Gourmet. Roughing it in the outdoors doesn't mean you have to eat poorly. We'll hear from guests who know some tricks of the trade when it comes to eating well in the backcountry, both backpacking and if you have some more cargo capacity. Thanks for joining us today on Outdoor Explorer. Our producer is Monica Gokey. I'm your host, Charles Wolforth. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.